This is Jeff Ruby, and I'm in the restaurant business.
And what were you doing the night of the fire, and were you there?
I was in Beverly Hills with my girlfriend, two other couples, and I was a regional director for Holiday Inns at the time. Weingartner Hammonds was the name of the company. And one of my managers says his girlfriend was her 21st birthday, and he wanted to take her to Beverly Hills. And another couple, it was our wine distributor and his girlfriend. And I didn't really want to go because John Davidson wasn't an act I was interested in. And I was there actually for the opening day of Beverly Hills, and Frank Sinatra Jr. opened the club. So it turned out I was there for the opening and the closing. But I've been there quite a few times. The Shillings were friends of mine. I was there for Red Fox, The Righteous Brothers, and music I liked, comedy acts I liked. And John Davidson, you know, was for an older crowd. But it was her birthday. So that's when Beverly Hills was a plush type of place. You know, there was nothing like it around here. So we went because I could get us in and I could get us good seats, which turned out to be a problem because we were front row center stage. And the problem with that was as far away from the exit as you could be. They had some ventriloquists as a warm-up act, an opening act for John Davidson.
Teeter and McDonald, the comedy team of Teeter and McDonald.
And John Davidson never, got on stage when the fire broke out. This kid comes on stage, busboy, and makes an announcement very calmly, very like a trained professional that's been in the business for 30 years and has dealt with this before. And that there's a fire. Stay calm. It's nothing, to be alarmed. It was a calming effect that, we just want to make sure and ask you to please go this way, go that way. And he kept everyone calm and that we should, just to be cautious, I'm asking everyone to leave. I couldn't believe, in retrospect, after, everything that happened, being in the business myself, how do you hire this kid? Which I knew later I did hire because, I knew he needed a job and he saved my life. But I took my drink with me. I didn't think we were in danger, but if I'm going outside May 28th, I'm going to be thirsty. So I brought Jack along with me, my friend Jack Daniels. And we start to go up on the stage, and then another busboy says, you can't go this way. Okay. So we start going another way. And my manager says, Jeff, we'll never get out this way. And that was to our left, facing the stage, it would be to our left. And there was not a line. That was just a mass of people. There was no line. And they're all going, trying to get out one exit, I suppose. Now, we were last in that mass because we had hesitated. We were going over the stage. So now we go to the other way. And I see big Scott Shilling running for his life, covering his face. I just said, this thing is serious now, I think. And busboy says, you can't go this way. And I, according to my girlfriend, who was interviewed by my co-writer in my biography, I said, F you, or whatever I said. And there's a good chapter in my book about it and what all happened. And every chapter is a song title. It's the soundtrack of my life. That chapter is Tragedy by the Bee Gees. She credits me for saving her life and the other four people with me. By my stubbornness and my being who I being Jeff, saying Jeff, you were this way and not being, well, okay, and at first I was. I said, well, okay. Busboy said he can't go this way. I said, okay. But then when it came down to a situation where we weren't going the other way, and my manager said, Jeff, we can't go this way. There's no way. We're at the end here. And I said, okay. But then when I saw Shilling, and then I saw smoke, and then I saw, and the busboy said, you can't go this way. I said, fuck you. We went that way. And then she put her head in my back of my gray suit, charcoal gray of all colors, and we're starting to make it through a line of people that were in front of us and people behind us in my back, and going through a hallway, a dark hallway. Now it was serious. I no longer have the Jack Daniels with me. In fact, he was the last person I needed at that time. And they start pushing. And I turned around and I said, everybody stop pushing. If we're going to get out of here alive, we're going to have to stay calm and not panic. And if you push, we're all going to die. So they listened to me. And the smoke was choking me. You know, it just gets in your throat. And the greatest sight, John, to this day in my life was seeing outdoors. Somebody had gotten the door open where you could see on Alexandria Pike where that sign, the Beverly Hills, the showplace of the nation. Well, when that door opened, and I'm down the hall, I saw daylight. I saw an opening through that dark cloud of smoke. I saw that daylight. I saw that outdoor Alexandria Pike, that grass out there. I saw freedom, you know, freedom. You know, I'm going to make it. People behind me didn't make it, a lot of them. And we got out that door. But Susan Brown, my girlfriend, Tom recalls, told the writer was there were steps there, but they were graded steps. So a woman could trip because her high heel would get stuck in the grates. They weren't solid. And then women were coming down after me. And I went back up to help them get down the steps. Between the long dresses and the high heels, the last thing you needed there was graded stairs. You don't even see them anymore. But of course, all after that fire, every building has been built. They're different in this country. That's why you don't see those stairs anymore. That's why you don't see doors that open in and so they open out and no, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's why there's more than two exits in a place that holds 1,000 people. But the eeriest part, one of was watching those dummies on the ventriloquist's shoulders coming out. For some reason, a memory that will last is looking at those wooden dummies coming out on the shoulders. For some reason, that was eerie. And seeing that in the midst of all of the flames, we got out. The door slammed shut because bodies got trapped. And a lot of people eventually found their way to that door and didn't get out.
So if you're sitting in the room looking at the stage, was it a door then to the right, an exit?
Yeah.
And when you went through the door, did you have to go down a hallway, or was there a maze of different stuff before you could get to actually the outside door?
Yeah. We got to that door. We got to that hallway, as I recall, and winding to the left, and then getting whatever path we took before I saw that opening. So if you're looking at a chart of the building and interior of the cabaret room, you look at the stage, you will then be able to draw a path of the path I took.
Okay, I've got a book with a map in front of me. So let me jump ahead here. You own many popular restaurants. They draw crowds. When you design a building, a space for your restaurants, how did what you experienced 40 years ago inform you in your business?
Well, I worked for Holiday Inn. I wasn't building or designing. I was running nightclubs and hotels and restaurants. And we were very heavy in the nightclub business, you know. In fact, we were competing with the Shillings. And we were really the people that began the nightclub singles bar, the single nightclub scene in this city, where the Holiday Inns. We didn't have a showroom like that. Actually, we had something like that. We had Top of the Inn on the 12th floor of the Holiday Inn.
Was that the Lucy in the Skies?
Came Lucy's, but originally there was the Playboy Club, which didn't have live entertainment. And then we did the Den of the Little Foxes before I got there. I graduated Cornell in 70. When I got there, I started working right there. They had the Den of the Little Foxes, and they had shows up there that were similar to Beverly Hills. But it was more the lounge acts that played Vegas instead of the main acts. And there was, you know, a prime rib buffet and crab legs, and it was pretty elegant and pretty good acts that you might see on TV and in Vegas in the lounge. They had pretty good lounge acts back then in Vegas that were pretty good name acts, but they weren't in the main room. Sinatra was in the main room, and they were in the lounge, but they were good. Well, we had those acts, and then we turned to disco when I turned it into Lucy's in the Sky, because that whole lounge act ran its course, and of course so did in Vegas, it did too. But Beverly Hills, you know, actually went into the name act thing. They didn't bring in Sinatra, but they brought in Sinatra Jr.
Sammy Davis Jr., Lou Rawls, I mean, many big. But when you're now opening a restaurant or designing, working with someone to design the space when you're going to open a restaurant, whether it's in this city or another city here in the Midwest, are there things that informed from your experience 40 years ago that you say, you know, in terms of occupancy or exits or traffic patterns that are in your mind because of your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I just did a place in Nashville that we opened in August. I remember going down to the building department personally. I said, listen, do you ever hear of the Beverly Hills Fire? No. I said, well, here's my biography. Go to the chapter tragedy, okay? I don't screw around when it comes to fire safety, okay? And because they're talking to me about electrical, you know, and wiring and UL listing. And, you know, I said, you guys don't know me. But I'm going to tell you who I am. I'm a survivor of the Beverly, not only that fire, I'm a survivor of three other fires. And one at my house, one in L.A., one here, I was in a couple fires. Of course, this one was the worst. But yes, the answer to your question, yes. Now, because of the fire, the Beverly Hills fire, there are fire codes that did not exist then, in terms of electrical, in terms of fire-rated materials, a la Stan Chesley, who fired everyone that made anything and invented the class action suit from that fire because of the flammable materials that spread that fire from the seating to just about everything. The seating being the worst thing. So now everything is fire rated, and you know you can't be in a public assembly place like that, or even your home. But of course, it's inspected much differently than it is in a private dwelling, or especially for a restaurant or a bar. So you have doors that you have to have an exit door, you know, every so feet, depending on the state or the city. You have to have different materials. You have to have different types of insulation, different materials for that. Fire-rated materials, UL listings on every wire, and the exit doors obviously have to open out, not in, because you open the door in, and that's where people, you know, the swings in, and they get trapped in the doors, and the bodies pile up, and they don't get out. The door opens out, you know, that likely won't happen. The door has to be fire-rated, you know. Those doors weren't fire rated. The doors could burn, though, you know. So there were no rules. There were no laws to speak of. So all that changed. Now, then I use common sense on top of it. You got how many feet you got to have for an aisle to get out. So there are laws now that didn't exist. How many people you can have in there now in a certain room or a certain area. So I don't know that that room was overcrowded. I don't think it was overcrowded. But what was wrong was everything was flammable. I believe the fire was started. I think it was arson. It's like, you know, when you have one coincidence or two coincidences, you chalk it up for just unfortunate, you know, circumstance. But when you have a pattern of coincidences that could keep happening and happening one after the other, it points towards a pattern of behavior that's intentional. And, you know, that place had been burned down year after year. It was set on fire, arson. One person died. Red Masterson set it on fire once, and the person that was in there, unfortunately, they didn't know anyone was there, and that person died, and it was set on fire again. You know, so there's been two arsons there at Beverly Hills prior to the Schilling zoning it. And that whole Kentucky, and the governor once said, Newport has a right to have it dirty if they want. That was the governor's quote, Happy Chandler. So I've done a lot of research on that. The chapter in my book, Tragedy, discusses that. The other guy, one of the busboys, wrote a book about it. You know, so they call it an electrical fire in the Zebra Room. And there was an inspection in the Zebra Room, or somebody had pulled up a van there in the Zebra Room to check. You know, I think it was arson. But they've covered up more stuff in that county and in that state, especially with crime, than was covered up in Chicago in the 20s. So there's no telling what happened.
everybody in your party got out okay, right?
Yeah.
And once you got down those graded stairs, did you stay for a while and help people out, or did you and your party and head down to Alexander Pike or what?
I helped the women out down those stairs that were stumbling, that couldn't get out because of the nature of the stairs being all graded stairs and them being in long dresses and high heels. And I don't even recall, my girlfriend noticed that and told the writer that. It had slipped my mind, but the door slammed shut. I didn't run into a burning building, no.
And the other question, I'd completely forgotten you had hired Walter Bailey. Was it for the precinct, the waterfront? What did you
have? No, I was at Holiday Inn at the time.
Okay, Holiday Inn.
I brought him into Holiday Inn. I went over to Pete Rose's house the next day and watched everything on the news. That's when I saw who this kid was, Walter Bailey. So then I went to search for that kid. I said, you know, I know one thing, that kid needs a job, and I know another thing, I'm alive because of that kid. So what I didn't know is, you know, he really didn't have a dad, and I became like a mentor to him. And I remember taking him to a Reds game, and Sparky leaving me tickets behind home plate. And I remember somebody taking a picture of me. I had my afro, and he was there, and it went in the AP, and it went all over the country because he was a hero. And that's when Norm Clark did a story or took it was an AP thing. And that kid came to work for us for a long time.
I guess it was 15 or 20 years ago when I was at the Enquirer, when we did one of our special sections, I interviewed him, and he was with a banker, a financial services company down in Dallas.
Yep, that's the last time I talked to him, too. He stayed in touch with me for a while. And, you know, we remain friends. He's like in his 50s or something now.
Since you've mentioned it, just so we get it here on tape, the name of your book is?
Not Counting Tomorrow. And that's one of the reasons it's called Not Counting Tomorrow, because you don't know if there's going to be tomorrow. I've been in a few life near deaths and life experience things. And I had my near death in 87 when I pronounced me brain dead and jumping out of the car my wife was driving. But this was a close call, too. But I've had closer calls than this one, but this was a close call. Robert Windler, who did the biography of, you know, he was a New York Times columnist at the entertainment section that in 300 syndicated papers every Sunday had 30 million readers, Time Magazine and People Magazine. And so he wrote it, co-wrote it, cleaned it up for me. And it's called Not Counting Tomorrow. And I came up with the idea of every chapter being a song title. And that chapter is Tragedy by the Beatles. So now it's at all of our restaurants. We have copies. It's, you know, so.
Jeff, this gets us there. I thank you. Thank you very much for it.
Thank you very much, John.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.